So let's just start with an introduction to Sefer HaChinuch itself, the book of mitzvah education. So this book is by unknown authorship. There's a lot of conjecture as to who wrote it, but it's not clear who the actual author was. He chose to be anonymous, and he's one of the few authors who was actually successful in that quest. Many authors who choose to be anonymous can be found out by different hints that they give throughout that book, but in this case, we're not sure who wrote the book. But what it does seem is that he wrote the book for his son and his son's friends as his son approached bar mitzvah. So it is written for a child, a growing child's understanding. So that's good for us at this point in our level of understanding of Judaism. And it has a, it has a specific structure that it follows. It goes, it bases itself on the information of different authors, particularly the Rambam and the Rif. When we say Rambam and Rif, those are contractions of the first letters of the names of different rabbis. So Rambam would be Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. So you have the R-M-B-M, Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. So Rambam. Ramban is Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. Just so you know, for in terms of Rambam and Ramban, it sounds very similar, but we pronounce it differently. Rambam, we emphasize the first part of the name. And Ramban, it's the second part of the name. So that even if you don't hear the N or the M in it, you'll know by the accent, Rambam, Ramban. So the Rif is, I forgot who he is, Rabbi Isaac somebody. Alfazi, I think, is the Rif. So it bases on him, and then later on Nachmanides also. So those three are the main pillars that he refers to in his introduction. He says, in all modesty, this is not my work. You might think, because of all the references I have in here, that I'm very knowledgeable and erudite. But in fact, I'm not. I'm just a good researcher, and I'm basing it on the works of these other people. It does become clear, not through my own knowledge, because I'm definitely not knowledgeable, and I base all my teaching on the knowledge of other people. But it does become clear through his writing that he is, in fact, that knowledgeable, but he is also basing his knowledge on his predecessors. But he does regularly base his information on the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot. So the Sefer HaMitzvot of the Rambam is divided into two volumes, and he goes through the positive commandments and the negative commandments separately. So the Rambam's initial contribution to Jewish law and understanding was the codification of it. So what he did was, he's basically, in a way, the first art scroll writer. So Lahavdil, because he wrote much more deeply than that. But basically, before the Rambam, you had Jewish texts. So you had the Bible, 24 books of the Bible, so 5 books of Moses plus the extra books, and then you had the entire Talmud. And if anybody wanted to know anything, they had to ask somebody who knew everything. There was no looking stuff up on your own if you weren't a scholar, because there were no indexes, there were no books that digested anything or would tell you just the straight up law. If you wanted to know how to make cholent on Shabbos, there was no way to look it up. You had to learn the entire Gemara Shabbos and the references around the Talmud that discussed cooking and ovens and coverings and products and all the different things that you needed to know to be able to bring it all together to know what is the law on making cholent on Shabbos. So the Rambam said, we need, at this point, when he wrote in the 1200s, we're at a place in Jewish history where people need easy access to the law. So the Rambam codified everything so that it was all by subject. So you could look up cooking on Shabbos. And he would bring everything from the entire Talmud into cooking on Shabbos into that place. So that was the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. But the Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot is the codification of the 613 mitzvot. So we know through tradition that we have 613 mitzvahs. There are a few different counts of what's included in the 613. 613 is the number, and then different counts. But the Rambam's is one of the main counts, and he codifies it in positives and negatives. So he lists all of them. The Rambam lists them by subject, so that all the sacrifices would be listed together, and all of marriage would be listed together. And so it might not, that was his order, was ordering it by subject. The Sefer HaChinuch then based his work on the Rambam's work, basically, but he listed it by Parsha. And he specifically wrote this book to interest his young son. And it's interesting to see in his introduction, which I think I'm going to read the whole introduction aloud, just because, let's see, should I read just that section? Yeah, I'll just read that section. page 3, which you don't have for those who have the photocopy. So I'll just read you this part. So I already explained his the way that he said that his whole work is based on the works of others. So he says that in his introduction. He says who they are. So I'll just read this last few paragraphs because it is interesting to hear what he wrote. These are the mighty men of old who spent most of their time clarifying the words of the Talmudic sages of blessed memory. They delved deep into the mighty waters of the Talmud, and out of the words of the Talmud they brought up pearls in their hands, so that the day we entered their holy temple and the chamber of their instruction, we found there a well of living waters, gardens and orchards, loaves and fine wool garments arrayed before us. Said I, how can I be accepted cordially to come and serve before these great men, when they have already clarified for us all these topics? Surely by arranging the 613 mitzvot according to the Sedra, according to the Sedras, the weekly parshas, that's his answer. Surely by, or, so he's not giving new information, just a new organization. Perhaps as a result, and here's so interesting, perhaps as a result, the young will become more interested in them, giving their attention to them on Sabbath and festival days, and will turn back from going wild in the streets of the cities to be enlightened by the light of eternal life. The youngsters of tender age will ask one another, how many are the mitzvahs in the Sedra of this Sabbath? And the earth shall be full of knowledge and wise thought. So it's so interesting to think about how in the 1300s, when this is written, we still have evidence of youth running wild in the street Shabbos afternoon. They're playing ball and they're goofing off, and the parents are saying, oh, how can I get these boys to sit down and learn something? I know, I'll write a book that will interest them. And then maybe they'll talk about how many mitzvahs are in this week's parsha rather than who won the last baseball game. So here then is the explanation of every single mitzvah prepared before them. Without effort, they will find words of delight in the sections of this work. May the holy progeny be blessed of God, they and their children and their dear ones, in all their places of habitation, and may I be included in the blessing with them. By the unique name of the Lord, I adjure every copyist of this work that he write this missive at its beginning. Then may life and peace be with him, for it is in order that all may give credit, honor, and esteem for it to its proper parents. Whoever corrects any error in it after intense study, may his reward be complete from God, and let peace be upon him, peace be upon Israel. So this last paragraph is really swearing an oath, causing an oath to be sworn to anybody who copies the work. So it was written, we'll see in just a minute, probably in the mid-1200s, in the 1250s approximately. And we know that from some of his references to, there's controversy about when it was written, but we are guessing that it was the 1250s, because when he talks about the laws of Shemitah, he says the next coming time for Shemitah is going to be 1257, something like that. So then you're guessing it was written before that Shemitah, so it had to be in the 1250s somewhere. However, then there are people who say it can't be, because anytime the Ramban is mentioned, it says Zatzal after his name, the sage of blessed memory. And he was alive in the 1250s. So how could it possibly say of blessed memory if he wrote it during his lifetime? But this sentence is the answer to that question. Whoever corrects any error in it after intense study, may his reward be complete. So he's giving the copyists permission to add in things or correct something if they find that something's missing. So it's very possible that after the Rambam died, as it's being copied, because this is written before a printing press, so it's copied by manuscripts, that anybody who would be copying it would then add in Zatzal after the name of the Ramban. So that we see that he's added in there like that. So, because it does seem that it was probably written earlier. So any which way, it was certainly written before 1310. So, because the controversy is between about 1250 and 1308, something like that. So it was written in that time. Right, and it's just interesting to think about this particular volume. I started learning it with Rabbi Wasserman yesterday, Rabbi Wasserman Sr. And so in his book, in Hebrew, it says who the author is. This book is very clear that we don't know who the author is. There's conjecture, but there's not clarity. Yeah, but we don't know who that was. We don't know who that was.
It says
ascribed to, but it's not clear. It's not clear, and there were a couple of Aaron HaLevi. So it's clear that he's a Levi, but it's not clear which, and it's clear he's from Barcelona, But we don't know exactly who he was and what else he wrote. And it seems that there was another one who was more famous at the time, but it's probably not him, because that particular Aaron that was a Levite in Barcelona wrote extensively about his family background and position. So why would he make a book anonymous after he's already written about his illustrious family? So there's still questions. It's not clear who wrote it, but it is ascribed. But it's not clear. So, right.
So the initial groundwork was laid, the compilation of all the mitzvot were gathered together by Rambam, and Al-Fazi.
Right.
But this unknown author then grouped it by the Parshot.
Right, Parshia. Okay. And then he gave specific structure to it. Okay. So the other works basically say what the mitzvah is, mm-hmm. and sometimes how to perform it. He gave a specific structure to each mitzvah, and you'll see as we go through it, each one has the same thing. There's a where is it found, where else is it found, what is the mitzvah, how do you do it, and to whom does it apply, and sometimes what's the punishment if you don't do it. And that structure is in every single mitzvah. So the where is it found starts out in the parsha, and we'll say the verse. And then where else is it found? So he wants to facilitate your looking things up. He wants to whet your appetite. So if you want to know where all the laws are, look in Tractate X on page, not on page Y, because there wasn't a page Y yet in Tractate X. Because at that time, the Talmud was still in manuscripts. So all you could do was say the tractate, maybe a word that started, but you couldn't say it. Not like today, where we have the Vilna Shas, and the Vilna Shas was basically typeset in the 1500s. Really, the Vilna Shas, the one that we have today, is from the 1700s. That order of the page is from the 1700s.
And 10A, 10B, 7A, 7B.
And that order of the page is unchangeable. So even though portions of the Talmud were excised from Christian censors, and then later found and added back in, they didn't add them back into the text. They put them as appendices in the back. Bless you. Because they were found and codified. They're found and codified after the Vilna Shas was already set up, after that page setup was already made. And so many places already referred to each page and where it is on the page as references, and so many people had already memorized the page setup and the visual, bless you, the visual memory of where things are on the page was already part of the collective Jewish mind, that they were not going to add paragraphs back in that belonged there, because it would have shifted the whole typesetting. So there's a thing that scholars can do, top scholars can do, it's called the pin test, where you could take a pin and put it into one letter of the Talmud, and a real scholar can tell you, if that pin would go through the book, which letters would it hit?
Wow.
Right? So, right. That's a time, it's not too many people can pass the pin test, but you should just know that's a thing, the pin test, right? So you're not going to mess up the pin test by adding in a paragraph, which will shift the typesetting of the entire book. So all those added in pieces are in the back now. So we do have a standardized thing that we can make reference to. And that's why we're, for instance, adopted the verse structure of the Bible. We had parshas. That's the way Jews divide the Torah, just in parshiot. So it would be parshat breshit. But the non-Jews wanted to have a stronger way to be able to reference. So they divided it into chapters and verses. The Jews don't have chapters and verses, but we did adopt the Christian chapter and verse system so that we could make reference, so that there would be a standardized reference way to refer to a particular sentence. And that really, if you think about it, is based in a strong concept that we have called Yeridat Hadarot, Yeridas Hadaros, where previous generations have more information and more strength of knowledge than we do. So every generation preceding us is stronger. So in a previous generation, you'd be able to say the first word of a verse and everybody would know what you're talking about, obviously. You know, like today, unfortunately, I don't know about you, I have teens, like the teens can do with movie lines, right? So if you'll say something's mostly dead, or if they say I'm in the mood for an MLT, you know they're talking about Princess Bride, right? Because you know that line in it. All you need is that one reference. Right? But you don't, because you don't have teens at home. But unfortunately. But so, like we have literary references in different things that we might have seen or read, that become
Shakespeare is classic. You know,
Shakespeare is classic, right? So sometimes people say a rose by any other name, so you'll know, you know, you can finish the sentence, right? So it used to be that as Jews, we collectively could finish the sentences of anything started in the Torah. So we didn't need those types of references to be able to find something because we knew, but we don't anymore. And we didn't for a long time. So that's why chapter and verse was instituted a long time ago to help with that reference system. And that's why we continually have further and further digested material. And that's why we, in trying to improve our intellect and our ability to access the sources, try to go back a couple of generations and strive to understand what they wrote rather than just satisfying our curiosity with aish.com, which is fabulous and I love it, or ArtScroll, which is fabulous and so helpful, and yet it is pre-digested. So if we want to, if we just want information, we can read that. But if we want to learn how to think like a Jew and understand things on a deeper basis, we have to go back a couple generations and try to understand their sources and get into the minds of earlier greats. So that's part of what we're doing here. Not only do we want the information that we're going to get from Sefer Chinuch, but we want to start being able to understand a little bit of what's going on. But something that's interesting to see is that they dealt with some of the same problems of kids running in the streets Shabbos afternoon. How are you going to get them interested? Right? So some things haven't changed. And yet, one thing that has changed, just look how he phrases this, that the youngsters of tender age will ask one another, how many mitzvahs are in the seder of this Sabbath? You know, like they're going to ask that question, but he's thinking it's true. He's not being ironic there. You know, he's saying, yeah, if I arrange it properly, if I make it yummy enough, then that's what they're going to talk about. Right. So, and how he says how it's the words of, without any effort, they'll find words of delight, but that he's thinking they'll delight in these words. So that may also be different than today's average, even religious 13-year-old child who might not find these words of delight, might find them words of homework, right? So so that was a difference at the time, is that this was the delight, that people should talk about this. And we have to think about that just in terms of our entire society today also. I mean, not only do we unfortunately have movies and television shows and all kinds of ridiculous books that fill our heads with thoughts that chase away. My grandmother, one of the things she used to say when I would read Archie comics and drove her nuts, she would tell me, don't put rocks in your egg basket. Right? So we have a lot of rocks in our egg basket because just our brains can handle a lot, but can only process so much at a time. So when we're busy putting rocks in our egg basket, there's not enough room for the eggs. But we have a society full of rocks right now. So we do need to clear some out in order to make room for eggs, but at least we want to look at some of the eggs that we could put there, should there be the space. But at this time, there were many fewer rocks around. So people did look more at this. These were the stories. This was the conversation. This is what people spoke about. There weren't the politics, and there just wasn't the stuff that we deal with today. Whether it's foolish or important, there wasn't that kind of access to information. So it allowed us to access different types of information. Okay, so let's see. Is that the main things that I want to cover in terms of introduction? Yeah, okay, so one more piece of information in terms of introduction to the book. The way that the book is currently arranged is that it goes through the Parsha and presents the mitzvahs in order that they appear in the Parsha. But that's not the way it was originally written. The way it was originally written did follow the order of the Rambam in that it ordered it by the Parsha but presented positive mitzvahs first and negative mitzvahs last in each Parsha. But that could get difficult to understand and was amended by later copyists where it was switched into the order that they are presented because occasionally one verse might have two mitzvahs, like for instance, keep the Sabbath and don't desecrate it. So there you have a positive, keep the Sabbath, and a negative, don't desecrate it. You might have 10 pages in between the discussion of those two mitzvahs if you're presenting it positive first and negative second. But really, those two mitzvahs have to be discussed in conjunction with each other. And so you need to have them presented, even though they're positive and negative, right next to each other. So while he initially did write it the way the Rambam did, positive first and negative second, it now is arranged in the order that you see it in the Parsha. And the last piece of introduction is the word shoresh, which means root. So he usually says the roots of this mitzvah, meaning so in this case that roots can be translated as philosophic underpinnings. Right, so the philosophic underpinnings of this mitzvah are. Okay, with that, this week I want to look at the first two mitzvahs. Now, the whole book of Bereishit only has three mitzvahs in it, pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Right? And a lot of sages ask, why do we have it all together? I mean, what's the whole point? If the Torah is a book of law, what's the point of the whole book of Bereishit? The whole book of Genesis really doesn't have a place in the Torah if the Torah is a book of law. That's a different discussion of why we have it. Pardon?
It's the background.
It's background, but it has to be more than that because it's not a history book. It's so, but yes, and there has to be an and because the Torah doesn't tell stories for the sake of satisfying your curiosity. That's not what it's about. So it has to be more than that. So we do have to look deeper into it. That's part of thinking Jewish. You always have to ask, why is this here? Why is this juxtaposed with this? Why does this omit a particular detail that you would think would be important to have in order to understand this? So we do want to learn to think in those ways as we're looking at it, to ask Jewish questions about the information. Excuse me. So the first part, so we'll start with Genesis. And as we go through these two, I want to read pretty much the whole thing. But as we go through, sometimes we'll read the whole thing, sometimes we won't, and sometimes we'll learn them in groups. If they don't apply, but these two really apply to our lives on a regular basis, and so it's interesting to look at them more deeply inside. Just so you know, for those who don't know that language, also inside means looking at the text, outside means discussing it without looking at the text. So you'll see some girls' schools learn inside and some outside. Some have philosophic differences about learning inside or outside. Beis Yaakov learns inside, Beis Vega learns outside. So we want to see it inside. So let me ask one of you, whoever wants to, just to read the beginning. I think we could probably even read the whole thing. Yeah, so let's read this whole mitzvah. Somebody could read it through in the English. It would be nice. Who wants to do that? Great.
Multiply multiplies the mitzvah. There is one positive precept in it, the mitzvah of procreation, as it is stated. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply.
Okay, so you see we have the mitzvah, we have the name of the mitzvah, and where it is in the Torah.
As regards root purposes of this precept, it is in order that the world should be settled and inhabited. For the eternal Lord, blessed is he, desires its settlement, as it is written, he did not create it a chaos. He formed it to be inhabited. This is an important mitzvah, by virtue of which all the mitzvot in the world are fulfilled, for to human beings they were given, not to be ministering angels. The laws of this precept, when a man is duly bound to devote himself to it, how many children he should have in order to have acquired himself.
Acquitted himself.
And from which mitzvot, religious obligations, he is left free while occupied with this, as well as its order details, as well as its other details, are explained in the Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Yevah Amoth, chapter in Tractate Berechov. It remains in force in every place and every time, and a man is obligated to strive for it from the time he is suited for it. This being the age of the sages of blessed memory, set for taking a wife, i.e. at 18, this religious obligation is not imposed on women. Anyone who fails to fulfill it in his life disobeys a positive precept, and his punishment is very great, for he shows personally that he does not want to fulfill the wish of the eternal Lord to settle his world. In Sidra Noach, there are no precepts.
Good, thank you very much. So it's interesting to see what he writes here, and he does tell you where you can go to find all the information about this mitzvah. You can look it up in the Talmud in those two places. And here are the questions that you'll want to answer. So he's not going through the entire thing, but you do want to know, from when does this mitzvah, if it's a positive commandment, be fruitful and multiply, when does that start? Is it when you're first capable, age 13, let's say? So you need to know, when does it start? And you need to know how long it lasts, and you need to know in what circumstances it applies, and you need to know what precedence it takes over other mitzvahs. So are there other mitzvahs that would be sublimated to this one taking place? So all that is discussed in these two places in the Talmud. Here it says chapter 6, so there was chapter division at the time because that's in the text. And then here in Brachot, in parentheses, it says 16a, so that's an addition of the translator of this work where he tells you where to find it. In the translator's introduction, he says specifically that he also based his work on other people's, but did put in the sources in the, he hopes, following the intent of the author to whet the appetite for further study, so to provide specific places for that further study to take place. So, let's see, so from the age of 18. So I think it's interesting just to think about, that's the time it's set for taking a wife, and it's a religious obligation not imposed on women. Mm-hmm. So why isn't it imposed on women? Why does this mitzvah not fall on women? Do you have any thoughts about that? Does anybody know?
It's because women are not obligated to have children, because at that time it was life-threatening, and men are required. And, I mean, usually wasn't a problem because most women, you know, have the mother's instinct, but because it involved a life and death situation, women were not obligated to get married.
Excellent.
Children.
Excellent.
So I was thinking more along the lines of the polygamy thing. It allows a man to be with more than one person and still fulfill it. So it's his duty to go out and multiply as much as he can.
Oh, so you're seeing it as a duty so that it would be good, more from like a Mormon perspective, have as many wives as you can so that you can procreate as much as possible because of this obligation.
Not necessarily that you have to, but it leaves that door open.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, that doesn't seem to be corroborated by other Jewish sources to say that it's a good thing to be polygamous. It's only a permitted thing in Judaism,
right,
to be polygamous.
But, you know, I'm going to show so much.
No, it's fine. We're all here to learn. We're all here to learn. So,
okay, Rachel couldn't have
children,
so he was with Leah, he was with...
And then the two concubines,
Bilhah
and Zilpah.
So that is the type of scenario that's supported by this, and then later on, but it's saying, well, if your wife is barren...
Right, so because there is a mitzvah of being fruitful and multiply, there would be discussion about if in a marriage fruitfulness is not possible, then is there a time at which that marriage needs to be terminated or supplemented so that this mitzvah can be fulfilled? So that does definitely open that possibility of discussion. What were you going to add? Do you have something else?
Basically the same thing.
Life-threatening.
It was life-threatening, and that most women have the desire to multiply, you know, to have children, and so it does not have to be an obligation on them to do that.
Maybe it's taking that animalistic aspect out of it, where men just want to, it's like, we'll do it with a purpose.
Good. Excellent.
Instead of just...
Excellent.
That's a good thought.
9/10 of the 613 mitzvot are man's obligation. A man has to perform them. He's obligated to perform them, whereas women only have, 5 mitzvot that they are supposed to perform?
No, we talk about the 3 women's mitzvahs, but that doesn't mean they're not obligated in many, 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 many more.
Well, they can do it, but there are certain mitzvot that are only for women.
Time-bound.
Time-bound, where men really have the lion's share of mitzvot to perform.
Yes, and women have plenty of mitzvahs. It's just we don't call, let's say, benching a women's mitzvah. But just because you're a woman doesn't mean you aren't obligated. You're absolutely obligated in benching. So there's plenty of mitzvahs like that, prayer, where women are obligated in it. Are they obligated in the 3 times a day from a sitter like a man? No, but are they obligated in daily prayer? Yes. So, but that's not called a woman's mitzvah. And the women's mitzvahs of lighting candles, taking a challah, and going to the mikvah, of those 3, only one, going to the mikvah for nida, is female only. If a man bakes bread, he must take challah. So it's not really a woman's mitzvah, it just usually falls to the woman. And if a man lives alone, he must light Shabbos candles. So... while we talk about those 3 women's mitzvahs, those are essentially female by nature in terms of what they, in terms of the philosophical underpinnings of those mitzvahs. but not because they're women alone. And so while there are many mitzvahs for men, there are many mitzvahs for women as well. And no one person can keep all 613 mitzvot, because there are many mitzvahs that are for Kohens only, and some that are for Levites only, and some that are for men only, and some that are for women only. So it's not possible for one Jew to keep 613. As a collective, we keep 613. Some only in the land, some only in the temple.
But isn't, more of a philosophical question now, really aren't the basis of mitzvot, aside from being, the commandments of Hashem to the Jews, more dependent on man performing because of his general nature? That he really, women are made according to God's will, but man really is needing to have more of a restriction on his daily activities, and he needs to be more
structured
in praying to God and controlling the Yetzer Hara. So mm-hmm. he really has more obligations in a sense.
Right, so you're bringing up a good point. Why do we have mitzvahs all together? What's the point of a mitzvah? So let's answer that question first. Mm-hmm. So can somebody give me a good definition of mitzvah?
Mitzvah is a commandment from God. From Hashem, tells us what to do.
Okay, good.
It's a guide on how to live your life for what was determined to be a good person. They also, in many ways, serve to separate them from the other cultures, saying, those of us who follow these are not Egyptian. We're not worshiping
mm-hmm.
the
God.
We're not doing the human sacrifices. We're not.
Excellent. So we have now connect to God, commandment, connect to God, separate from others. So lots of reasons for mitzvahs. And so definition of mitzvah is commandment. Any other definitions of the word mitzvah?
Is it commandment or deed?
Commandment would be the literal translation, the most often used.
I know it's
not deed.
Used,
right. It's not actually deed. So the root of the word is tzava, which is commandment. Not tzava army, which is with a bet and an aleph, but tzav with a tzadik and a vav, commandment. But that same root, tzadik and the vav, in Aramaic, is the same root as the word for pliers. So, and that's something that's not constrict, connect.
Right.
Bring together two disparate ends. So that's a very important root understanding, philosophic underpinning of the word mitzvah. Because while it does literally mean commandment, the question is what is actually going on here? Does God have a bunch of arbitrary rules he's just telling us to do, and if we follow them, we're in relationship, and if we don't, we're not? So the whole system is about us being in relationship with God. So it's to connect us. So a mitzvah is a connector. So it connects us and God, but it is connecting us and God, but what it actually connects is us, is the physical and the spiritual. Humankind are the only creatures that are physical and spiritual together in one being. So we know that we have a soul. We know that we are our soul. And that if we lose any part of our body or even our whole body, we still are our soul. So we're not defined by body, we're defined by soul. Right? So we know that the soul comes into the body at a certain point, and there's questions about when the soul comes into the body. But a general thought within Judaism is 40 days. There's all these 40 days after conception. There's this famous joke, right? There's all these different religious definitions of when does life begin, in terms of the abortion debate, when does life actually begin? Right. So that's the Jewish definition. The fetus is viable, right, when they graduate medical school. Yep. Absolutely. So, but short of that, we believe, and here's a vocabulary word for you, ensoulment occurs at 40 days after conception. So that the hunk of flesh that's in there dividing up cells actually receives the soul at 40 days after conception. But the soul is received, which means the soul exists before. So we do understand that the soul exists before conception, and that the soul continues to exist after the body expires. So we're a soul before there's a physical body, and we're a soul after there's a physical body. So we definitely have to ask, what's the point of the physical body? Why this sojourn in the physical world if our essence is spiritual? And if the whole point of our existence is spiritual, and if our eternal existence is spiritual, why have a physical journey at all? Why be spiritual beings having a physical experience? So the answer to that question is because the physical offers us something that we can't accomplish without the physical. The physical offers us something that we can't accomplish without the physical. Without the physical experience, we can't achieve something spiritual that we need to achieve. But we have to have the physical tool to accomplish it. So in order for our soul to undergo the proper transformation, it has to actually dwell inside a body on this earth for whatever period of time. For some souls, it's a fleeting moment. A stillborn just needs to be ensouled and brought down to earth and then brought right back. That's all they needed. And for some of us, it's a much longer process. And for most of us, it's a several-phased process because we do believe in reincarnation. So the question is, why is our soul here? Why does our soul have to wear a body for however long it has to wear it? We do use our body and the physical body that we live in and the physical world that we live in and all the physical needs that we must tend to are all tools for spiritual development. And that's what a mitzvah is. How do I develop myself spiritually? By engaging in these physical things. Or by refraining from these physical things. And that's how you can understand every single mitzvah. Every positive mitzvah is, what should I do to develop myself spiritually? And every negative mitzvah is, what should I refrain from to not damage myself spiritually? So it's all, how do I develop or what should I refrain from? How will I take care of my spiritual growth? How will I grow myself? How will I not diminish myself? That's what positive commandments are and negative commandments are. So thinking about that then, we can look back at this mitzvah and say, why is it a mitzvah to procreate? Isn't that a natural urge of human beings? It's for sure a natural urge of women. Yes, we have that maternal instinct. We want to have children. We want to be able to give. We want to raise them. Although anybody who has teens or sees people with teens could wonder. And I always think it's the biggest miracle when a mother who has teens has another baby because she knows what she's getting into. And that's like amazing. But we do have a maternal instinct that does drive us. But men do too. It's only recently, really only in the last 50 years, that people have seriously thought about not having children, putting it off for so long, or not having them altogether. It has only really been a lifestyle choice that's very recent in human history altogether. Right? It just didn't exist. Pardon?
Flower power.
Right. So it didn't exist before then. As a concept, to totally put off, maybe to do it later. Sleeping around for sure existed. Having fun physically for sure existed. Mm-hmm. But to not have children, this is a very new thing. So even men were driven, I mean, by an urge to leave something behind them. It was interesting, as I was learning with Rabbi Wasserman, senior. So he and I are separated by exactly 30 years. Both of our birthday is February 8th, which I found out on my 40th because I saw somebody buying balloons for his 70th. Mm-hmm. So I was listening to him, and he was saying, why should this be a mitzvah? Because every man wants to leave behind a legacy. And I'm thinking, not every man. Every man in his 70s is thinking about legacy, but not every man in his 20s is thinking legacy at all. You know, it's totally being filtered through an older man's mind, these thoughts. You know, because a 20-year-old is not thinking legacy.
Right. Right? Interesting. A man of 70 can still do something about it.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's,
yes.
Yeah, that's so true. Even if you've done whatever mm-hmm. all through your 20s, 30s, 40s, you know, up to 70,
you can still have a child.
You can redeem yourself.
Yes, right. You can. That is true. That is true. So a man really, actually, I think his whole life has the power to still father a child, whereas a woman does not.
Right.
So, a woman's ability is for a shorter period of time, right? Uh-huh. And a man's ability is a lifetime ability. From the age he reaches maturity, usually until death, he has that ability. So that is an interesting point. But the question remains then, why make it a mitzvah? So one of the concepts that we have with mitzvahs, which we say in Pirkei Avos, is Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lezakot Et Yisrael Lefichach Hir Be'lehem Torah Mitzvahs, right? God wanted to merit Israel, and therefore he increased Torah and mitzvahs. So when something becomes a mitzvah, something that you do regularly anyway, if you have in mind that you're doing a mitzvah, when you do it, then you get the mitzvah points, or you do the world transformation. Mitzvah points there is a very low way to explain it. But the spiritual transformation that occurs when one engages in a mitzvah then occurs when somebody has in mind that they're doing a mitzvah. So when you pay a cab fare as you get out of the cab, you're actually doing the mitzvah of paying a day laborer for their labor on that day, which is a mitzvah from the Torah. So you could just pay them, and you paid them, and get out of the cab. Or you could have in mind, I am doing a biblical mitzvah at this point. And then you've done spiritual transformation and paid them.
So if you don't have that in mind, you're doing it just because
Right, you've been trained to do that, right?
Well, I mean, you know, he gave me a service. Of course I'm going to pay him.
Right.
But I'm not thinking, well, gee, I'm doing a mitzvah. We don't get the mitzvah points.
So you don't, you have not, it's true, you do not
really
affect the same level of spiritual transformation if you don't have in mind.
Transformation.
The spiritual transformation. You've still paid the person on time.
Right.
You still have not caused a chilul Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but have you caused the appropriate Kiddush Hashem? Have you, you know, have whatever it is, have you done what you could do with this? And so this happens all the time. I mean, there's plenty of times when we might bench but not think about it. Should we therefore not bench? Bench is say the blessing after grace after meals.
Okay.
Birkat Hamazon, right? That's called benching. Benching is actually Yiddish for blessing. So we often use it for benching. When we say benching, it usually means the grace after meals. But it can also mean, it can also be used bench lecht, lighting Shabbos candles. Lecht is light, so bench lecht, or licht benchen is the time of candle lighting. You could say, when's licht benchen this week? Right, so 5:58 or whatever it is this week is licht benchen. And it's also used to bench the children. Friday night, you bench the children. Is a blessing for the children.
Mm-hmm. I kind of have a problem with the mitzvah points because it's almost like, you know, you want to be teacher's pet. Look, teacher, look.
Good.
What I'm
okay,
doing.
So that's why I said mitzvah points is a very low level way to understand it. So
no,
it's not mitzvah points.
But it's on a higher level. You said same thing. So
uh-huh.
It's almost like, you know, you're trying to get the attention of your teacher. Look how good I'm being. I mean, Hashem knows everything. He even knows what we're thinking.
Right.
So I thought it was up to us to be a light onto the nation, you know, to show how a good Jew can behave.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, you know, it's almost like you just do it because you want to be a good person, a better person. But to always say, well, I'm doing this for a mitzvah because I want...
So the question is, how do you enhance it? So I just sent somebody grocery shopping for me. I had on the list 10 pounds of flour, and they brought me back 2 5-pound things of Pillsbury bleached all-purpose flour. And I looked at it and I thought, ugh, that's not even flour. I'm a real flour snob, total flour snob. So most of the flour I get is King Arthur. We get a mail order, and I have bread flour and artisan flour and rye flour and whole wheat flour and white flour and pastry flour and, you know, high gluten flour. And, like, I'm total flour snob, right, because I do a lot of baking. So when I looked at Pillsbury bleached flour, I'm thinking, oh, I wouldn't even want to put it in a cake, for sure not in challah, because the flavor of the challah is really dependent on the flour. You can definitely tell. If you use King Arthur's bread flour,
really?
As opposed to Hungarian, which is what I usually use, the Hungarian unbleached flour for all-purpose flour, but if you use King Arthur's bread flour, the challah is much stretchier. You can really feel it. You can feel it in the tear, and you can feel it in the chew, and you can feel it in the crust. It's a much more delicious challah. So you could make your challah with any ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I could put in that Pillsbury bleached all-purpose flour, but it would not be a delicious challah. It would be adequate, and a non-flour snob would say, fine, this is great. But they wouldn't feel the nuances of a really delicious flour in the same amount of work. It's the same amount of time to make it. It's the same amount of energy to knead it. It's the same amount of energy to braid it and the same amount of heat and energy to bake it and put it on the table. But if you use a high-quality flour, it will be much more delicious. So if you use high-quality intention, the mitzvah is much richer. So you can do the same action, but with different quality ingredients,
mm-hmm.
and you'll come out with a better product.
Isn't it also, how can you get credit for something? I mean credit in a very loose.
Mm-hmm.
How can you get credit for something if you're not even conscious of it? So if you get out of the cab, and you hand him the money, and you walk away, and you have no idea that you have just enhanced or done a Torah mitzvah. How can Hashem give you credit for it if
right.
you don't even
you
know?
Pretty much can't. In that situation, especially with a cab, because it is the way of our society to pay a cab driver instantly. So it would be different than, let's say, paying your cleaning lady, which the right thing to do is pay her that day. But in our society, occasionally we will make her wait. We'll say, I don't have cash. Do you mind if you wait till next week? Or that kind of thing. That does happen with a gardener. You don't pay them on time. Things like that happen. If you haven't made arrangements previously, there are people who will make somebody like that wait, which is a transgression of a Torah law in that case, if you didn't make previous arrangements. If when they come, you say, the banks are closed today and I don't have cash, I won't be able to pay you. Do you mind working today and I'll pay you next week? If you say that beforehand, then you're not transgressing. But if you say it afterwards, then you are. Even if they agree, you're not paying them on time when you're supposed to. So in our society, there are times when we wouldn't keep that mitzvah. So let's say we're just a nice person and we recognize this is a person who's dependent on their daily bread, and I'm providing some of their daily bread, so I want to make sure I give it to them without it being a Torah law. So then we might get some credit just for paying attention to taking care of this person and ensuring that they have their daily bread, even if we're not somebody who lives that way on a daily basis. It's interesting. I learned recently, or a few years ago, that the reason why we bring Shiva houses food is not because a Shiva sitter is not supposed to get up and prepare food. It's because if you didn't work, you didn't eat. You work every day for your daily bread. That's how it used to be. So if you weren't going to work because you're sitting Shiva,
they would have no food.
You didn't earn money, and so you didn't have anything to buy food with. So your neighbors brought you food because you weren't working that day. So today we've translated into, oh, sit, don't do anything except for thinking about morning. But that's not it. The custom comes from you worked every day for your food of that day.
So taking a step back for a second, if you're doing it with the intent of it being a mitzvah, when you're supposed to say your blessing, then in today's society, isn't our whole day just, I mean,
everything that we do is a mitzvah.
I mean, back then, you know, 3,000 years ago, there weren't as many constant interactions and constant.
Okay, so that's a good question.
But
so,
today, that's all you do is say one prayer after another, or blessing.
Well, we do say lots of blessings. So let's, the whole concept of kavana then can be developed in a general and specific sense. So today, around the table, all of us can think, oh, now I know it's a mitzvah to pay a worker, a day laborer, the day they do the work. And so from now on, I will have intent to be fulfilling a biblical mitzvah when I pay a day laborer. So I'm going to always make sure I have money to pay my cleaning lady. I'm going to always make sure that I think about it when I pay a cab driver. But next time you take a cab, you might not be thinking about it. But because you resolved today to always think, now you know it's a biblical mitzvah, and you're fulfilling a biblical mitzvah when you do it, you are generating kavana today, kavana intent, you're generating kavana today for those future mitzvahs that you'll do. And then it does become an intentional act, even if you forgot in the moment that it was an intentional act, because you've generated that intention right here and now. Now you know it's a biblical commandment, and now you have intent. That doesn't mean it can't be enhanced further by thinking in that moment that I'm doing this mitzvah right now. You know, add a smile to it, add a thank you to it, right? Whatever it is, you are enhancing it in the moment. But still, if you've generated the kavana today, the kavana does last then. For as long as you remember that that's such a thing. It does last, probably even past when you remember it. Which doesn't mean then, the math is very complicated. That's why there's no mitzvah points.
Well, I know, but it's a nice way
right.
of...
It is a nice way of saying it. So the math is very complicated.
It's on my level.
Right, okay, so let's go back to mitzvah points for a minute and just talk about the complicated math, right? Okay. So you now have intent that you're paying on time, or maybe you're the type of person who didn't regularly make sure you have cash to pay on time. And so now you're going to step up. But now it's 10 years later, right? 10 years later, you always make sure. Always on Thursdays, you take cash out when you do a grocery shop, so that always on Fridays, you have the money to pay your cleaning lady. It's an always thing you never forget anymore. You're done with that trial. You always remember. You're not getting the same mitzvah points for that mitzvah as you got this year when you struggled with it. Because you've conquered that territory. But you are still accomplishing growth. So there's different levels of points that you get for each mitzvah when you do it. But let's just take mitzvah points a step further. What you're really doing is creating a relationship with God. So just like in your marriage, bless you, you can bring your husband coffee, Or you can bring him coffee in his favorite cup with the exact right kind of milk he likes. He likes 1% and not whole. He likes whole, not 1%. He likes cream, and you usually don't give it to him because he's got a little weight problem, but you see he's down a little bit. You're going to give him that drop of cream because he really loves it. It's a special geschmack or whatever it is. Like, but you know these things about him, and when you put that cup of coffee in front of him, you are strengthening or building or both your relationship with him by that cup of coffee and by the smile that you put it there with. Right? So all of those factors go into how much is your relationship strengthened at that moment with that act based on what you were thinking and what you did in that time. And that's what a mitzvah is. You're not waving to your husband, aren't I the best wife in the whole world? Although occasionally we might have to do that, right? But what we're doing is creating relationship through the act. So that's what we're doing with God. We're creating a relationship through the act. So we want it to be the highest quality act possible so that we create the best relationship possible. Because there will be relationship withdrawals and relationship deposits. And that so there is not actually a point system, but like in a marriage, there's not a point system. You did this, so you're that bad, and you did this, so you're that good, and this cancels it out. It's not. It's in this area you're weaker. So maybe I don't trust you always to pick up my stuff from the cleaners because you've shown me in that area that you're not trustworthy. And yet I completely trust you in terms of talking with other men because you've shown me in that area you would never have an affair. I 100% trust you there. I don't quite trust you there. Right? They don't cancel each other out. Mm-hmm. They're separate realms, but in one relationship. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's the way it is with God too. There's not points, but it is a way to think about it initially.
So I learned something from Rabbi Maya last Thursday, and he said that if there's a mitos that you're weak in and you're trying to improve it, you get more credit when you have overcome that mitos. Like if you lie a lot and you really overcome that and you're telling the truth, you get extra credit.
For telling the truth every time you tell the truth? I think you get credit for overcoming it. But my understanding is once you've overcome it, then every time you tell the truth again, you're already dealing in conquered territory. So it's no longer a struggle. So it is a tricky math. Yeah. I mean, I guess we're up to time, right? Is everybody looking? We should bring it to a close soon. Yeah.
Okay. I was just thinking, one of the ways that I think about it, trying to think about the mitzvah when I do it, that when I do that, I actually am giving honor to Hashem because I'm recognizing that I'm doing something that He advised me to do, and in that case, like your father. When your father advised you to take a particular action or not to take an action, when you follow his advice, you're really bringing honor to your father mm-hmm. by following what he says to do. And that honor can account to points, to blessings, to rewards of some kind somewhere, someplace. Maybe not here on earth necessarily, but I think of it also as I am honoring him when I think I'm doing what he advised me to do to make me a better person and to connect closer with him.
Yeah. Good. So let's wrap it up by talking about purposes of mitzvahs, because I do want to answer that question. Why is this commanded to men and not to women? So some of the purposes of mitzvahs are connecting us to God, giving us physical pathways to accomplish spiritual achievements. Some mitzvahs are given to us that are regular mitzvahs. Pay somebody on time. How hard is that, really? It just makes that everyday act. It, A, teaches a value, pay people on time and respect their work, but it also makes your everyday act into a mitzvah, which then elevates you by doing something every day. So it's possible that one reason why this mitzvah is given to men is because even though they have a desire also to procreate, that it elevates the everyday act into a mitzvah realm. And so that when they do something that they anyway desire to do, they can, by adding in intent, make it into a holy act when they're fruitful and multiply. And it's not just, I want to see my seed continue, I want to leave a mark on the world, I want to have progeny, I want to have somebody to care for me. It's not just that, but it elevates it into the realm of the mitzvah. And for a woman, it's not commanded because there are no commandments that require us to give up our lives except for, and it's not a commandment, but the concept that we do have to die al kiddush Hashem occasionally, and we shouldn't be tested in that. But there are times when we would have to give up our lives rather than commit a specific thing. But there's no mitzvah in the 613 that says give up your life or puts you into life jeopardy to do the mitzvah. Like there's no mitzvah, like, for instance, collecting, let's say you want to chase away a mother bird from its nest, right, to get the eggs. if you see a bird on a cliff with a nest, you're not supposed to climb up there and get it, right? Your life isn't supposed to be put in danger to do a mitzvah. It's v'chai behem. You're supposed to live in them. If it endangers your life, you're not supposed to do the mitzvah. So that's a case where you could do the mitzvah, but it would endanger your life. You're not supposed to do the mitzvah. Here is a mitzvah where a woman's life is in danger each and every time, so it is not her commandment. However, I think there's one other important factor. Mitzvahs teach us values, and they shape our lives, and they shape the community. So they do distinguish us from other nations, and they shape our community. One important impact of this being a male mitzvah and not a female mitzvah is that a male can't do it on his own. He must convince a woman to be his partner in this mitzvah. And so he has to promise her, I'll take care of you. I'm not going to leave you vulnerable with children. What's more vulnerable than a single mother, you know, alone in the world? How is she going to make a living? How is she going to raise the children? How is she going to? It's so difficult. And so what woman would want to, I mean, and today it's different because our financial situation is different. And our social services and social safety nets are so different than in the past. But think 100 years ago and all the way past. What woman would knowingly get pregnant without some kind of safety to help her raise the children and put food on the table? So a man's going to have to somehow marry her or promise her or some way convince her, I'll be there by your side. I'm not going to leave you alone. And so he has to, and I'll be nice about it, right? That a woman needs to be able to be picky, hopefully, to say, should I make myself that vulnerable to you? Will you promise me enough? And it's his mitzvah. So he has to find a woman to do it with. So he has to make the promises necessary to convince her to make herself that vulnerable to him. So I think it actually protects women to have this be a male mitzvah. So it's not just about her life not being in jeopardy, but I think it's about women and society in general. It's protective of women to make this a male mitzvah. Because it didn't have to be a mitzvah at all. But I think that it does protect women to make it the mitzvah of a man and to require him to figure out a way to accomplish the mitzvah, which must be done with a woman without it being her mitzvah.
Well, and there's legal underpinnings, the ketubah.
Right. So it is manifested in the ketubah, but he can't say to her, it's your mitzvah too. Without me, you won't be able to fulfill it. Mm-hmm. You know, he can't say that to her. All he can say is, I have a mitzvah that I need to fulfill, and I can't do it without you. Please partner with me. I'll take care of you. You know, but that's what it has to be. So it's not her mitzvah. So he can't put that on her. And he has to request her assistance in fulfilling this mitzvah and take care of her so that she'll be willing to do it. So I think making it a male mitzvah, right, and then having it in the ketubah, all the promises that are there in terms of marriage. A ketubah is a legal document that says, I promise I'll feed you, clothe you, house you, and sexually satisfy you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those promises are made in the ketubah to take care of her. So, I think we're going to end on this one, and we'll start with the next one about circumcision. But
which is also a part of this whole.
Yes, it is. Really important. Right. So we'll see that one more inside, and then maybe we'll go a little faster, but we'll see what there's. No mitzvahs in Parshat Noach. So we're caught up with the weekly Parsha now. We did last week's, and this week's will be on schedule for next week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.